The recording that you're about to listen to is a talk from the City Bible Forum. We would appreciate you respecting our copyright by not making copies of this talk or altering the content in any way. We hope that you find the material beneficial. If you would like more information on the City Bible Forum, you can visit us on the web at citybibleforum.org.
Good morning. I don't know about you, some people find Christmas so taxing that they just can't wait for it to be over. I'm a Christmasophile myself. I love getting presents. So my postal address is Nana, but I love giving presents. I love choosing presents. One of my problems is that having bought a good present, it's so hard to keep it till December the 25th. Today I thought we would address our minds to the heart of Christmas once again. I want to ask you a question, but because of the day and because of the topic, you know what the answer is, which kind of means you're cheating. So stop it. I want you to see if you can... What do you think is the grandest, and I've stolen that word from C.S. Lewis, is the grandest miracle Jesus is involved in? See, it's no good. That would be much more fun if it wasn't Christmas, wouldn't it? As you know... In a sense, the obvious one is the resurrection of himself from the dead. I lay my life down, I take it back again. I have authority to do these things for my Father, he says. But I want to suggest to you the one that lies behind them all, the one that we often don't think about, and the great thing about Christmas is it forces us to think about, or nearly, is the incarnation. Some of you will eat, as I lived on for about 6 months when I was a bachelor youth worker at Hornsby, chili con carne. We had a man who worked for Nestles. And he could buy those large cans that I don't see anymore that they used to have, large cans of chili con carne. And you could just pour it in the pot and just reheat it. And then you got this terrific substance at the bottom after about a month. But chili con carne simply means chili with meat. And the incarnation is the in-meatment. It's from the Latin. It's the infleshment of Jesus. Now we see that you'll know that there's only two accounts of the life of the birth of Jesus in any detail. One in Matthew's Gospel, that if you read it, seems to be told predominantly with Joseph as the source or through his eyes. If you look at Luke, it's predominantly from Mary's perspective. This may be because of Luke's dealings with her after the resurrection of Jesus. They both lived and moved in various parts of Greece and Turkey, as far as we can tell. Matthew has the account that you have just read to you. Just before we get to the heart of it, I want you to notice something, because it's contrary to what we can think, where it says in verse 19, Joseph hears that his betrothed wife, that is, the vows have been given, but they haven't taken to living together yet, so they're technically what we would think married. So if someone wants to break the betrothal, they need a divorce. So it's got all the weight of the promises, but none of the benefits of being married. And so it says, Joseph, her husband, being a righteous man, not wanting to disgrace her, planned to send her away. The word normally and rightly translated as divorce. It is the sending away of the marriage partner. And just lovely, I think, to see that when the Bible uses the word righteous, it is not in some sort of contrast to mercy and kindness and tenderness that we will tend to think of. A person being overly righteous will sometimes be seen to be harsh. Joseph here, because he's a righteous man, instead of doing what would have been natural and normal and his right, which is to publicly shame the wife or the betrothed, who has certainly brought him into discredit by apparently having had sex with someone else, he decides he will send her away, which makes sense, but he will do it secretly. And that's what a righteous person does, according to the Bible, not perhaps according to some parts of the church at times, that a righteous person will do what is right, as gently and as kindly and as tenderly as they can, even to someone who in Joseph's mind has terribly betrayed him by having had sex with someone else, and not after sort of years of getting weary of his style, but just who knows why. But as you heard the story, Joseph gets a message from God he's not to do that. And the explanation of Jesus is in verse 23. I'd like you to draw your attention to that. It's in capitals because it's a direct quote from the Old Testament through the prophet Isaiah, who says, a virgin shall be with child and shall bear a son. You shall call his name Emmanuel. and the name Emmanuel, we're given the meaning of God with us. And there's this promise there in Isaiah 7 that there would be a child born of a very young woman. The word in Hebrew can mean a young woman. It usually has the sense of a virgin, because in that culture, if you were a young woman, you were a virgin on the whole. So the words are pretty much interchangeable. But the significance is what the Son will be about. He is God with us. There is this whole track from Genesis 2, the second chapter of the Bible, right through until the second last chapter of the Bible, about the problem of the apparent absence of God. You know, you may well believe in God, but you'll be much more probably conscious of the presence of the person across the table from you, the person with the microphone, etc., than the presence of God. And in the story of Genesis, before humankind gave God the finger and said, get out, mind your own business, we'll do it our way, God is said to have come and walked with the man and the woman in the cool of the afternoon. It's a beautiful picture of friendship, going for a walk together, that we could do with God. Second last chapter of the Bible, we're finally told that the dwelling of God shall be with man, that we'll be, as it were, reunited. But here in the middle of it is a promise that there'll be someone who can rightly be called God with us. Now that's going to be filled out as we go. It just sort of splat on the table. What does it actually mean? In what sense is God going to be with us in this child? And as often happens with God, he sort of over-delivers. One of the few quotes I like from Kerry Packer is where he says, it is better to under-promise and over-deliver than over-promise and under-deliver. And my sense with this promise in Isaiah 7 is this is what God does. You just get a sense there'll be someone who will bring something of the presence of God, God with us. But it gets filled out better than the Jews, the Israelis could have ever have hoped for. It is terrific to have someone with you. You know that nonsense, well, it's said, we see it meaning well often, I'm with you in spirit. I haven't heard that expression, but it's always a kind of a nonsense, because the thing about being body people, you're either with someone or you ain't. You can wish them well, etc. And I discovered this a couple of years ago when I went to the family court, the ironically called family court, just to witness the divorce, my divorce go through. I just thought, a bit like viewing the body and the corpse, I thought I should just make sure I see this and confront it. And so I went, and then a friend of mine, Rob Smith, who some of you will know, I was just chatting with him about what I was up to and wasn't making a big song and dance about it. And then Rob said, I'll come with you. I said, mate, there's no need to come with me, I'm fine. But he said, no, I'm going to be there with you. And I tell you what, I was very, very glad on the day that he was. I looked at, it's a shame we can't have any sort of Christian kindness, I think, in that court as we used to in some of the older courts, because it was just a lonely room. There were just four or five lonely people. There was an Islamic woman next to me with a scarf. She just looked shattered. There was a couple of other blokes and women there. And I was the only person who had someone with me. And there's just something, it's hard to express, isn't it? What it's like to have someone geographically with you. And what the Bible is saying is that there will be this child who will be born, who the Jews waited for about 600-700 years after this promise, who will be, in some sense, God with us. And that's a promise worth waiting for. Now, we're flicking on, if you want to move down to John chapter 1. This is the Christmas verse, above all Christmas verses, I would think. I came to appreciate it, I think, when I was in my first year working at the Shore School, where I was blessed to serve for 9 years. And I was getting introduced to this world of what I describe high culture. They did at the end of the year, where I really felt like a barbarian, just trying not to burp at the wrong time. That was my fear, that I'd do something that would reveal that this magnificent carols and lessons thing based on the one in Oxford or Cambridge or some foreign university. It was just beautiful and cultured, and I was tense the whole way through, but I think I managed to hold it together. But my policy was to change nothing in my first year, just try and understand what on earth is going on in this place. Except when we came to this carol service, I knew it was going to be full of people who didn't normally go to church, and there was traditionally no sermon in this thing. So I had the right to change whatever I wanted, the sort of license I had, but I thought, I'm not going to. And I was arguing with the old deputy head, for whom I was his worst nightmare, and he actually behaved very well through the whole time. And I was arguing, no, we should have a sermon, even 5 minutes. And he was arguing we shouldn't. And I thought, okay, I'm going to go back to my original policy. anyhow, they had the nine lessons which tell the story leading up to Christmas magnificently. The choir master had chosen fantastic songs that complemented the readings. And the guy who was down to read the last reading, some of you will know this, unless they've messed it up with poetry that they now do with some of these services, was this passage, John chapter 1. And historically, people stand for this particular reading. And I was just, enduring it and seeing what I was up to in the program. And then Ken Gilmore got up to read, one of the finest Christian men I've ever met. Ken got up and read it. And I just thought, how dare I think that I should give a sermon, compared to this passage. John 1, verses 1 to 18 is some of the finest, most important and beautiful writing you're going to find. It actually reads better than, it reads aloud, I think, even better than just with our eyes. But look at what it says there in the first three verses. In the beginning was the Word. Now, I spoke about this 2 years ago, so I know you know everything about this passage, okay? You remembered it all. And if you weren't there, you remembered anyhow. This very cheeky beginning where he picks up exactly the same beginning of the first book of the Bible. In the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth. John, in a very postmodern way, picks up the phrase and twists it. In the beginning. When everyone's... was the Word. The Word was with God. And the Word was God. He was with God in the beginning, which is just a repeat of the second line there anyhow. He wants to stress the fact that as far back as you go back in the presence of God, he is not a monad. He is not on his own. That there has always been this companion with God. With the Father was this person who he chooses to call the Word, which has deep resonances from the Old Testament, because God does all his creating through the Word, and it has deep resonances in Greek philosophy. The Word, reason, logic, where we get our word logic from, logos. He says, right back at the beginning was the Word. This being was with God right back at the beginning. More than that, in a shocking statement that is either blasphemy or extraordinary revelation of truth, the Word was God. He was with God in the beginning. Now, verse 3, he then just says, he just underlines this by telling us that the Word does what God does. This is what the Jews understood. This is the God thing. All things were created through him. Apart from him, not one thing was created that has been created. So you can't have a higher statement of a person's essential and eternal being than these. And you can spend years working through, and some people have, just these first couple of verses. But then you just need to get that before you get to verse 14. Having told us who this being is, the Word, God, he then says an unthinkable statement. The Word became flesh and took up residence among us. We observed his glory, glory as of the one and only Son from the Father, full of grace and truth. This statement, it is the sort of thing, it's the great distinctive heart of Christianity. It's what makes some people sing and dance and worship. It's what revolts other people. That the God who created all things should speak to humans, fair enough. But that he should actually become flesh. Now, many of you will know that other things you've heard and learned, that there's a number of words in the Greek that the writer could have chosen to describe becoming human. Could have said he became a man. There's any number of words he could have used which has an implied dignity about our status and our capacities. He chooses here the earthiest word as something. He chooses here the flesh, sarx, that is bone, fat, gristle, tendon, skin, sweat glands, bodily fluids. It's humankind in a sense at his most smelly, at our weakest. Sometimes revolting, if you cut me open, I'm nowhere near as pretty as I am even with skin on. And saying that the great, I keep wanting to use the word infinite, but that's not a useful word, but the great seemingly limitless creator of all things who inhabited eternity has actually become, not just for a passing visit, but has actually become exactly the same as you with your body, with all of its problems, all of its embarrassments, all of its parts that we keep hidden because, you know, that's just what we do. That the eternal Creator became flesh and dwelt among us. Uses the word that is almost always used. It's used back in Matthew 1. It's the word that the New Testament, it's tabernacled. He tented with us, referring back to some Old Testament business with God. So here is this extraordinary, this is the very heart and center of Christmas. This is why people stand sometimes when this is read, like they stand in the Hallelujah chorus with the Messiah. Because it's so majestic. This long, long, long journey down, 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 is the very heart and glory of Jesus. And that's what he says. We've observed his glory. At the moment of his almost grotesque, and I've met people who have some understanding of the vastness of God who got very, very angry at this verse and have said it's blasphemy to speak like that of God, that God should become like us, that God should need to go to the bathroom, that God should become fully human, truly human. In that context, he says, we observe his glory. I don't know if you see much glory. The time I sometimes think about the word glory is when I'm in my tinny, not the boat itself, it's when I'm in the tinny looking out from the boat. It's because I always go fishing very, very early in the morning. It's that when you're cruising along the harbour, looking out towards the heads as the sun comes up. I don't want to be corny. I know sunrises and sunsets have been done to death, but there's a reason for that. But when you just, that's the word that comes to mind, glory. It is so big and beautiful, and every time is different. And you see its magnificence. You see Sydney in its, I think, its very best. Early, early in the morning, when the lawyers are at work and nobody else is yet. And that's when Sydney's at its best, you see its glory. So you see the glory of Jesus. You see the glory of the Word who was God there. And that's why in the end Christianity has been and continues to be a song-generating religion. And that's why I'm going to hopefully have time to read to you some of the songs that have been written in response to this. Because there are certain things where the mind gets to the edge of its capacity to understand. I had a conversation about 4 weeks ago at a little party I was at with a guy who's doing a PhD in maths. And I haven't had this experience for some time where I was asking him questions to help me understand the area of maths he was doing. And twice I had this feeling of vague internal panic because I just felt, I don't understand this. I know it's... he was trying to go slowly. I can't even recall. I have so little understanding. I can't even recall the area of maths it was. But he was trying to take me through this area of maths. And I like to think I've got a V6 engine. I can follow most arguments. But I just couldn't get it. I'm not sure if he got it. I don't know. But he sounded as if he got it. But it is one of those things that we don't understand something is no necessary reason to not believe it. It just may mean that my V6 is just out of its league at this point, like my little computer is often out of its league. So here we have the eternal, limitless God who makes all things actually would have looked like me. Probably not as handsome, according to what the Bible says. Because the only thing we know about Jesus was he was not much to look at, according to Isaiah. And then he lived with us. You could bump into him. You could be rude to him. He could let you in. You know, let you do a lane change in front of him and you won't even wave to him and say thanks. You know those people who do that? But he was... And this is the significance of what humans do to him. The reason why Christians have this thing of lingering on the abuse and the bashing and the whipping and the spitting and the pulling out of his beard and the crucifixion is not just because we've got this macabre enjoyment of horror, but it's because we have a sense of who it's being done to. That's people don't get, you really don't get the Jesus story unless you get sort of act one, which is he is the eternal dwelling amongst us. So let me read you, just in case we don't get to it, a hymn. If you go to most churches now, you get to sing this hymn about once every 3 years. It's written by an Anglican clergyman. Well, actually, He became a Methodist, but that's... Oh, dear. Anyhow, let me read it to you. I won't sing it, although I'd like to. Christ by highest heaven adored, Christ the everlasting Lord. Late in time behold him come, offspring of a virgin's womb. Veiled in flesh the Godhead see, hail the incarnate deity. Pleased as man with man to dwell, Jesus, our Emmanuel. I mean, and he didn't even go to Moore College. It's extraordinary. But I mean, that's what this is about. Late in time, behold him come. There's a sense of the Jews had been waiting a long, long, long time. And in the history of the universe, the Bible knows it's late in time. It's right in the last act. Offspring of a virgin's womb, veiled in flesh, the Godhead see. This is the great longing and impossibility to see God. You can, veiled in flesh. Hail the incarnate deity. Pleased as man with man, he was happy to dwell as one of us. Right. I was in Melbourne. Princess Mary and her sweetheart went past me in a massive convoy, in what looked like an armoured truck they were in. They were not pleased to dwell with us. They were pleased to dwell under very safe circumstances. But God comes down and dwells us just as a fellow human. Jesus, our Emmanuel, God with us. It is, it's either the most magnificent, the most dramatic, the most extraordinary, the most beautiful. It's the day of days, or it is utter stupidity. I don't see how it can be much in between those two. Then for those who love the Apostle Paul, and there's one quote from Paul there in the sheet. He just picks up what the rest of the New Testament says, as you'd expect. Verse 8, be careful that no one takes you captive through philosophy and empty deceit based on human tradition, based on the elemental forces of the world, and not based on Christ. For in him, the entire fullness of God's nature dwells bodily. Now this is just paradoxical, isn't it? It is inconceivable to see how the entire fullness of the God for whom the universe is small dickies. The University of Hawaii, some of you may have read, has worked out how many grains of sand there are in the whole earth. I've forgotten the number, but it's big. Lots. This is not just in Hawaii, it's zillions. But the number of stars in the universe is much, much more than the number of sand, bits of grains of sand upon the earth. All that from God, that the fullness of that Creator should dwell in a human body. Although that's easier to believe now than ever, isn't it? One of the great things about modern physics is it has shown us that far from human beings' capacity to easily understand everything, the further we go into the very tiniest of the tiniest of the tiniest particles, the more bizarre and paradoxical the universe seems to be. Therefore, I think it's kind of easier to believe that at the heart of the reality of God's work in the world, you are stuck with paradoxes than it was perhaps 100 years ago. When the physicist at the end of the 19th century thought we'd pretty much got to the end of physics. And then it's like the floor opened up. Like, oh dear, didn't know that was there. So we are struck with paradoxes that all the fullness of God dwells there. Now let me just finish by drawing your attention to six things that flow from this. Firstly, crystal clear revelation is what you get. We observed his glory. That's why we read the Gospels, because you read there the telling of the story. And it's the witness. See, if God just wants to tell you what to do, which is what some religions think, that's what it's basically, it's a whole series of commands, do, 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 it's all this constant imperative. If it's just about you getting the will of God right, you don't need God to come and live with you. He can speak through a donkey, as you know, as he does once in the Old Testament, which is, some of you know, is my great hope that he may one day speak through me. He can speak through a burning bush if he wants to. But that's not what he wants to do, because if you want someone to know you and to see your character and to engage in relationship, in the end you probably need to come and visit them and stay with them. It brings clear revelation. It enables the atonement. I'm of the great Christian family. I'm of the mad Protestant variety on the whole. And we tend to speak about the birth of Jesus just in terms of it getting to the death of Jesus. Which is, I mean, Athanasius, the great Egyptian bishop back in the 4th century, argued that. So it's got a noble tradition, but there's something about the very fact that he becomes man which is worth dwelling on and having a feast over. So I do hope at Christmas you will lash out. It's a feast day in Christian history, and you ought to get the very best of eating and drinking and explain to friends why. It reminds us, I think, of the great nobility of creation. There is a weird habit in spirituality around the world that the more spiritual you are, the more you deny your body. You beat it. You starve it. You inflict pain on it. That is utterly unchristian. Because what this is saying is that God can come and dwell in a human body. There's nothing unspiritual about the human body or the ordinariness of life. Most of the life of the incarnate God was spent working, earning a living, looking after his mum, who was had lost her husband before Jesus went public. It so protects us from dangerous spirituality. There's an early heresy that Christianity had to deal with, and it still pops up, I think, even amongst my friends, frankly, although without its name, called Docetism. And in Docetism, the idea is that Jesus was really God. He just seemed to be a man. He wasn't really a human. He had no, and I love this polite phrase, he had no evacuative system. Right, so he had no large intestine. Because at one level, it's easy for me to mock my ancient Christian heretics, but they just couldn't bring themselves to believe that if God became human, he would also go to the bathroom. But there's this tendency to somehow say, no, don't involve God in the tacky. No, he came down and became one of us. It explains also the Christian view of Scripture, totally human, totally divine, exactly like Jesus. That's our model. We don't believe that the Bible is sort of typed as the direct command from Gabriel. That's not the view the Christians have at all. It's totally human and totally divine like Jesus. Second, lastly, it shows us the glory of humility. This is why Christianity brought to the... And John Dixon's big on this. He's got a book on it. He's got talks on it. You can find them. Dr. John Dixon. Christianity brought to the world the virtue of humility. The Greeks, the Romans, it was not a virtue at all. Why? Because God is humble. God shows his glory by stooping right down. So it brings to us that... So if you're feeling, if you're the senior in some situation, there is nothing below you. Right? Only the ones who don't know what it is to be great can't stoop down low. And lastly, it's good to sing about. But I'll stop at that point. So we've got some time for questions. Okay, folks, let's have a few questions. So I take it we have 9 minutes. No problem.
A bit less, because we have to finish.
8 minutes. 7 minutes. Okay. It's okay. Took the early Christian church about 300 years to work this out. We can sort it out here. Why was Jesus not named Emmanuel? Good question. Because Matthew writes the gospel 60, 70 AD, 30, 40 years after Jesus died and risen, and says he will be called Emmanuel. But we actually know for a fact he wasn't. That the early, you have lots of people running on saying, Son of David, Jesus. No one runs after him as Emmanuel. Which is one of the many ways in which you see the way in which the Bible does not just read back into Jesus what people do, which is a constant nonsense people have. There are all sorts of phrases that are used of Jesus in the gospel that are never used after him, such as the Son of Man. The early church didn't call Jesus the Son of Man, but he's constantly... Why? Because that's what he was called. Why does Matthew say he'll be called Emmanuel when he didn't seem to be called Emmanuel? Because he is called Emmanuel. Christians have actually been calling him Emmanuel now for 2,000 years. But at the moment he was alive, no one knew quite what to call him. Blasphemer, sorcerer, Lord, teacher. One of the games that you watch going on through the Gospels, what category do we put this man in? So he wasn't called Emmanuel by... He wasn't called... Well, maybe that was his middle name, we don't know. Jesus, Emmanuel, son of Joseph, we don't know. But so that, I think, is the answer. He has been called Emmanuel for some time. Like by John Wesley in Hark the Herald Angels Sing. Is the virgin birth crucial for Christianity? Don't know. I see no reason to play with it. People who tend to play with the virgin birth tend to probably want to play with anything that smacks of God acting directly and immediately and unusually in his world. As Peter Slezak, the very thoughtful atheist from UNSW says, you know, if God makes the world, resurrections and virgin births are really chicken feed. So the question is, if you believe in that sort of God, I presume it might be possible to know Jesus and to trust him for forgiveness and as the guide of your life and not believe in the virgin birth. I don't think it's a healthy position to be in. But then I smoke cigars and they're not very healthy. But I don't think it's going to kill me, although I might be wrong. See me in 50 years. And it's not a doctrine that anything is ever built on. When I've had dialogue with Muslims at various times, they seem to think that we think the virgin birth is why Jesus, the Son of God. That's a link the Bible, I don't think, ever makes. It's just stated as a fact. That's actually what happened. And I see no good reason not to believe in it. Should we be encouraged to stand for the gospel readings in church? You should do whatever the eldership in your church suggests. I don't think it's a bad thing. As a sort of an Anglican, we tend to do it in communion services. We stand for the gospel reading. Some of my friends say, oh, the gospel's not more important than Paul. Well, it sort of is, really. That really is the heart and soul of it. It's Jesus. So I don't think it does us any harm to stand for that. But perhaps a bit like the way we used to stand for older people when they came into the room and stand for women when they came into the room. It's a way of showing special respect for certain people. I don't think it's a bad thing. Should we cherish the Christian traditions of Christmas? Yes, I think so. A bit like, I don't want to make my life a model for anyone else because it's been a disaster, really. But it's covered by grace, so we're doing okay. But I think whoever it was that gave me the wisdom, and I don't know where it came from. I took advice from a number of people, that when I went into Shaw School, where there'd been lots of Christians thinking away about how to do stuff, not to assume that everything that was foreign to me was stupid. And not to try and change everything in the first year so it becomes an image of my particular limitations. And I think, so for example, with the carol service, it drove me nuts. 400 people in the chapel. And I don't get to preach. Do you mean I've just got to let the Bible preach? Give me a break. But so I think often there are traditions that have got more wisdom than we're aware of. Some of the traditions are just, in the words of Jesus, they're just the traditions of your forefathers and may have been good when they were set up and can now be destructive. But I think my generation, I don't know about what generation you're in, tends to have a quick look at something and go, rubbish. And I don't think that's wise or humble. So I think it's good to look at some of the traditions and take them slowly. What was the Jews' expectation of the Messiah at the time? As far as we can tell, I mean, there were different, Judaism, like any community, whether they be Marxists or atheists. I was with an atheist down in Melbourne doing some panels, and he wants to write a column in the distinguished newspaper that they won't let him write. He wants to write a column which would have the heading, Dickie Dawkins is a Dickhead. Now, I'm not suggesting that as a good topic, but he's an atheist. He's probably Australia's only regular columnist whose heading is Godless Gross. Every group has its divisions. Once you've got, let's say, more than three people, you've got politics. The Jews had different expectations, but the primary one that Jesus was constantly wrestling against was the political Messiah, the one who would destroy evil, that is, the Romans. And Jesus says, no, I'm actually on about something much deeper, much more profound, much more evil, that won't be solved by killing Romans because someone else will come. It'll be solved actually by me being killed. It's a much more profound and subtle evil. I've got a minute. No, I don't have a minute. I better shut up. If your question wasn't answered, do see me afterwards. And if it wasn't answered, well, that's like most of them. I've got some wonderful quotes here from C.S. Lewis, and the first four people who come and offer me $50, you can have them.
Thanks very much, Ian. So, as I said, today is our last talk for the year. So, a couple of very quick thank yous. First of all, to Ian, who was our regular speaker this year. Lots of other speakers, including that. Thank you very much.
The recording that you have just listened to is from the City Bible Forum. For more information about City Bible Forum events in your city, or to order other talks, please visit citybibleforum.org.